Good morning and welcome to Environmentally Sound. I am Bob Lebensold, your host for the series on the natural world, education and culture, and chronicler of the demise of Homo sapiens. We bring you guests from diverse disciplines, scientists, activists, authors, educators, entertainers, and public officials. We seek to stimulate your curiosity, intellect, and passion. Today's news from the natural world. Today is Thursday, August 9th, 2012, the 51st day of summer. It is 10:09 Eastern Time. Yes, you are live. We have lost 2 minutes of daylight since yesterday, 30 since last we met 2 weeks ago. The sun rose at 6 o'clock this morning. It will set at 8:01 this evening. We will have 14 hours and 1 minute of daylight today. The moon will rise at 11:47 this evening. It will set at 1:43 tomorrow afternoon. We reach last quarter phase today. The next full moon is August 31st, and it is a blue moon. Colloquially, that means it is the second full moon in the same month. The first this month was August 2nd. So on August 2nd and on August 31st, the second of two full moons in any month is called a blue moon. And of course, you can see why the expression once in a blue moon has come about, because it's a fairly rare event. And actually, there are two blue moons in two separate months in certain years. The next one is 2018. So those of you who hang on for 6 years will get to experience that rare event. I think it's January and March of 2018. There will be no full moon in February. Occasionally, rarely, there's actually a blue appearing moon. But that's not what we mean when we say blue moon. We mean the second full moon of any given month. Next high tides in New Rochelle, 5:22 p.m. Rye Beach, 5:18 p.m. in Yonkers at 3:38 p.m. Dobbs Ferry, 4:06. Tarrytown, 4:22. And in Peekskill at 5:01 p.m. Now, a regular feature, names of American service members who have lost their lives at war. May they live on in all of our hearts. Corporal Daniel L. Linnebarry II, age 23, from Hubert, North Carolina. He was with the 2nd Marine Division, was killed in combat operations in Helmand Province just this last Monday, August 6th, just 4 days ago. 3 days ago, excuse me. First Sergeant Russell R. Bell, 37, of Tyler, Texas. He was with the 82nd Airborne, one of two soldiers killed by a roadside bomb in Kandahar Province on August 2nd. The other was Staff Sergeant Matthew S. Sitton, age 26, of Largo, Florida. Specialist Kyle B. McLean, age 25, of Rochester Hills, Michigan. He was with the Michigan Army National Guard. He was killed by an improvised explosive device in Kandahar Province on August 1st. All these casualties are, as I'm sure you know, from Afghanistan. No more Americans are dying in Iraq that I know of. First Lieutenant Todd W. Lambka, age 25, of Fraser, Michigan. He was with the 1st Infantry, one of two soldiers killed by a roadside bomb in Paktika Province on August 1st. The other one was Private First Class Jesus Jonathan Lopez, age 22, of San Bernardino, California. Marine Lance Corporal Curtis J. Duarte, age 22, of Covina, California, with the 1st Marine Division, killed in combat by an IED, improvised explosive device, in Helmand Province on August 1st. Gunnery Sergeant Jonathan William Gifford, one of two gunnery sergeants killed in the same incident. Jonathan William Gifford, age 34, of Palm Bay, Florida, and Gunnery Sergeant Daniel Joseph Price, age 27, of Holland, Michigan. They were both with Marine Special Ops Regiment, and they were both killed in combat in Badges Province on July 29th. Private First Class Jose Oscar Belmontes, age 28, of La Verne, California, with the 10th Sustainment Brigade, one of two soldiers killed by small arms fire in Wardak Province on July 28th. He was killed along with Sergeant First Class Bobby Lee Estley, age 38, of Lebanon, Ohio. Specialist Benjamin Carlos Pleitez, age 25, of Turlock, California. He was with the California Army National Guard, died of a non-battle-related injury in Mazar-e-Sharif on July 27th. And as always, when it's a non-battle related injury, I wonder. And since I've read that there are quite a number of suicides, one can only wonder what happened to specialist Benjamin Carlos Pleites, age 25. Private First Class Theodore Matthew Glend, age 23, of Rochester, New York, right up the road here, 173rd Airborne Brigade Combat Team, killed by small arms in Logar Province, July 27th. Staff Sergeant John Eric Hansen and First Lieutenant Sean R. Jacobs were killed in the same incident. Sergeant Hansen was age 41 from Austin, Texas. Lieutenant Jacobs was 23 from Redding, California. They were both with the 2nd Infantry Division, and they were both killed by improvised electronic device, I'm sorry, IED is improvised explosive device in Kandahar Province on July 26th. They were both in that same unit. These 15 American servicemen were alive when last we met 2 weeks ago. The one fellow was alive on Monday. That was Corporal Daniel A. Lineberry, age 23. He was just killed this last Monday. Please think of them. You should not be embarrassed to cry for them. Each death is a great loss to their families and to all Americans. May they live forever in our hearts. And may this feature come to an end in the near future, because there are no more deaths to report. Time for the Culture Corner, my reviews of plays, movies, opera, ballet, museums, and what have you. Keep in mind that these are my opinions, and you have the right to disagree with them, because everyone has the right to be wrong. We saw the film Moonrise Kingdom, about a couple of kids who run away. Some very well-known actors appear in Moonrise Kingdom. Bruce Willis, but this is not a Bruce Willis movie. Edward Norton. Nope, this is not an Edward Norton movie. Harvey Keitel, but you guessed it, also not a Harvey Keitel movie. Willis is not a gutsy cop who risks his life at every turn. Norton is not a smart, devious con man, and Keitel is in no way ominous. No stereotypes here. So it's not action. It's not drama. It's not adult romance. It's not even adolescence coming of age. It is kind of pubescence coming of age, if that is a genre at all. I'll just call it a fantasy. So you have these two 12, 13-year-old-ish pre-adolescents, one boy, one girl. They're misfits in their circumstances, so they escape from the artificial world in which they live to create one of their own. They even get married with the help of a man with marrying credentials, but of course they don't really understand marriage, just togetherness. And it's not really a marriage, but it's kind of tender in its own silly way. If they were two boys or two girls, they wouldn't be getting married, but they'd just hang out in the way of friends, which these two truly are. So they do get away, and the adults are all concerned, and there really isn't much message other than the one we have seen many times. That is, people with troubled lives are just in the wrong circumstance, and if they can change to other circumstances, they will be happy as larks. If only. So if you like puberty coming-of-age tales, if there are any, then you will find some charm in this movie. If you want to be uplifted without having to suspend belief in too many ways, then probably not. I mean, when someone is struck by lightning, he doesn't just get up with soot on his face and go about his business. Fantasyland. Besides, I like Bruce Willis as a cop or as a hero. Sure, he's versatile, but if you aren't Brando, who could do everything with equal skill and be known for no one style, then why not be what people love you for? Bruce is a good actor, but his natural personality shines when a role is infused with humor as well as guts. How he got cast in this film and why he accepted it, someone will have to tell me. I just can't figure that out. The person who saw this film with me enjoyed the charm and quirkiness. Yes, that was there, but when you were paying $10 plus for a movie ticket, you have to choose carefully. My guest today, I'm just going to bring him on for a minute before our first break, is Matt Hayashida. He is a musher. So what is a musher? A musher is a sled dog driver who races in the Iditarod, the annual 1,000-mile race across Alaskan tundra, in way, way, way below zero temperatures. Welcome, Matt Hayashida.
Hey, how's it going, Bob?
Good morning. Nice to have you on. Let me just explain to our listeners that there is a delay. You're in Alaska, and you're on a cell phone, so they may have to just deal with that little delay. So we'll be good, right?
Yeah. I can hear fine. So, yeah, I apologize about the delay. I noticed on this end, too. So.
Yeah, no, it's not on you. It's just on the world as it is. I'll just ask you, when you do hear the music, the theme music, that means that if you're in the middle of something, you'll tie it up so that I'll be able to interrupt you and take our break. First of all, why don't you just tell us in the minute we have before we go to break, what is the weather in Alaska like today?
The weather right now, it's typical Southeast Alaska in August. It's in the mid to upper 40s right now, overcast with intermittent rain.
Well, it doesn't sound too bad. It does sound kind of typical. I understand, actually, that it's mostly overcast in Alaska. But 40s, I mean, we're in the 80s here, and it's pretty uncomfortable. Probably going to hit the 90s. And rather than risk getting into a break situation, which is difficult, I'm going to take the break right here. We'll be back in just a minute. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. If you're listening in Holland, Michigan, Scheveningen, Holland, Lebanon, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Oregon, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Missouri, Illinois, or Kentucky, or Beirut, Lebanon, you have logged on to www.wvox.com, and we will be right back.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, claims for first-time jobless benefits fell by 6,000 in the latest week to 361,000. That's below the 370,000 that economists were looking for, and once again, the prior week was revised higher. Meanwhile, the trade deficit fell to the lowest level in a year and a half in June, thanks to a steep drop in the cost of importing oil and a small rise in exports. The trade gap fell to $42.9 billion. That's below the $47.5 billion analysts were looking for it to narrow to. May's reading was also revised lower to just over $48 billion. And shares of E-Trade are on the rise today after the company fired its CEO. The company ousted Steven Freeberg just 2 years into a four-year contract as the online broker faces declining trading by customers. While E-Trade searches for Freeberg's replacement, its chairman, Frank Petrilli, will serve as its interim CEO. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Lauren Simonetti.
Jay with SafeLight Auto Glass.
We know you depend on your vehicle. So when you have auto glass damage, you need it fixed fast. SafeLight has more glass in stock than anyone. So when you schedule a replacement with SafeLight, we'll get you back on your way faster. Plus, our work is backed by the only national lifetime guarantee, keeping you covered anywhere.
Just tell your insurance company you want SafeLight or call 1-800-800-2727 or go to SafeLight.com.
SafeLight Repair, SafeLight Replace.
There's always something happening with Bob Lebensold on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com.
1460 WVOX.
Okay, we are back. We are speaking with Matt Hayashida, a musher, which is a dog sled racer. He is speaking to us from Skagway, Alaska. And let me just remind you or just inform you again that we are having some connection problems. Matt's on a cell phone, and he is 4 hours earlier than us. I don't know if that makes a difference. But the connection does cause a delay. So try to understand and wait for the fascinating the remarks, even though you'll have to wait a few seconds. Okay, Matt. Let me just set you up, and then you can go on and answer this. First of all, the Iditarod is billed as the last great race on Earth, and it has quite a history going back to 1973, so it'll be 40 years in 2013. Why don't you just give us a summary of the Iditarod, what it is, and how it came into being?
Well, the Iditarod is it's a sled dog race that goes a total of 1,049 miles, and the racers go from Anchorage to Nome, Alaska, which is about the same distance as New York City to Miami. And the origins of the Iditarod, actually, the whole reason why there is an Iditarod is because in the mid-1960s, snowmobiles became very popular in Alaska, and the native sled dogs, the native huskies, were actually on the verge of extinction. So a guy named Joe Reddington Sr. came along. He's the man that started the Iditarod, and he simply wanted to preserve the legacy of the sled dog. So that's why he started the Iditarod. And the race every year, we go over, it's a national historical trail. And so we follow the same route that the old Gold Rush prospectors used to go in and out of Iditarod. They would bring supplies in, into the interior of Alaska, and then they would bring the gold out on the same trail. And we also commemorate and follow the same trail that the 1925 diphtheria serum run ran on, which there's actually a statue of Balto in New York City Central Park. He's one of the participants. He would be the lead dog on the final leg of that famous serum run. So we commemorate that every year, and I'd say there's probably about, on average, 80 dog teams or 80 racers that compete. And a dog team consists of 16 dogs and one musher. There's no outside assistance when we run the race. And on average, the winner completes the race in about 9 days. Last race is about 14 to 16 days, somewhere around there.
Okay, that's very interesting. I know that Balto was one of the dogs in that historic diphtheria run, if I'm not mistaken. And yet there are some who say there was a different team with a different dog that were the true heroes of that. But in any case, Balto gets the credit. And, you know, I've seen that statue in Central Park many times. I never knew what a dog statue was doing there, and I never took enough interest to find out. So that's very interesting to me. It was erected in 1925, if I'm not mistaken, and it, according to what I read, it's become one of the most popular tourist attractions of all. Okay, so now, you say you start with 16 dogs, but I think it's actually, there's some variation, isn't there? You can start with fewer, and you don't have to finish with your whole team. How does that work, Matt?
Right. So, yes, we do. The maximum number of dogs that we have on our team is 16. The minimum number that you can start is 12. However, most racers do start with 16. And as we progress along the race, there are a series of checkpoints that we have to go through, different villages that we go through. And on average, they're about 50 miles apart. So when we go through at each checkpoint, there's a team of veterinarians. And so they give a full examination to the dogs. If we find that the dog is not feeling well or perhaps has a minor athletic injury, what we do is we put the dog in the sled, take it to the next checkpoint, and then we sign a piece of paper that the veterinarian gives us saying that we dropped the dog from the race. And the veterinarian will then load the dog on an airplane, head it back to Anchorage, and we got somebody there to pick up the dog. And we would be down a dog. We cannot replace dogs as we go. So, but we can continue racing knowing that the dogs are okay.
So the
the dogs that
start must finish. I mean, every dog that finishes had to have been in the start, as you say. Now, there's something that that you said that piqued the question. I know that PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and other groups object to any kind of stressing of an animal in any way. But it seems to me that you take really good care of these dogs. I mean, I saw your kennel in Alaska when I was there the other month, and I see the love that you give to these dogs, and I see how they really want to be hooked up and run. I mean, that's what they're bred for. I wonder if PETA thinks that the happiest pet is one who just gets overfed and just lays around and eats and craps and pants and sits in front of the TV and just has a life of leisure. Why is that a better life?
Well, and one thing, one note on dropping dogs and different things and this might be of interest if somebody is within that organization, is that sometimes when we drop dogs, it's the dog is perfectly happy and sound and it's willing to go. However, because of it is a race, and due to the nature of the race, you're only as, and just like any competition, you're only as fast as your slowest member. Therefore, sometimes we do drop dogs if they're a little bit slower than the rest of the team. And with that being said, you could actually speed up with less dogs on your team. Now, I'm going, touching on that issue with animal rights activists, I'd first and foremost like to state that I myself am an animal rights activist. Meaning that the whole reason why I got into the sport of dog mushing is because of my love for dogs. And when I first saw it, I definitely, heard about it, I definitely had some reservations. It's, for myself, it was like, wow, is it really fair to have these dogs pulling and this is their job, but when I first saw it and I saw the enthusiasm that the dogs had for running, it almost appeared to me that it would be cruel and inhumane not to let the dogs go. Because obviously this is what the dog is bred to do for thousands of years, and it's what they love to do. So that kind of changed my mind that's kind of it in a nutshell.
That's interesting. Okay, we're going to come back with you, Matt, in just a couple of minutes. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460 in New Rochelle, New York. I am Bob Lovensoul. This program is Environmentally Sound. My guest is Matt Hayashida. He is a musher, an Iditarod racer. He races dogs across the tundra in Alaska for 1,000 miles. We will be right back.
With world and national news 3 times an hour, here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. In the middle of his trip to Colorado, President Obama said voters who choose Mitt Romney are choosing to make health care and contraception more costly.
They want to take us back to the policies more suited to the 1950s than the 21st century.
In Grand Junction, he paints the former Massachusetts governor as a protector of the rich. And at the state fairgrounds here in Pueblo, the president is expected to focus on middle-class workers and the economy. This as Romney supporters, like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, continue their Colorado bus tour while Romney fundraises in New York.
Fox News Radio's Jennifer Kuiper in Pueblo, Colorado. Realtors say there was a drop last month in foreclosures on home loans.
For the 22nd consecutive month, overall foreclosure activity fell by 3%, and for the year is down 10%.
Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern in Washington. Fox News. We report. You decide.
Under new and top-notch management, Leon's Taxi Service in Larchmont is now Depot Taxi and Limousine Service, managed by Charlie Scott and Maria Valerio, who are known for their extensive experience in the transportation industry. Larchmont's Depot Taxi and Limousine Service acquired new automobiles and access to new stretch limos, always ready to safely drive you to a wedding, a graduation, a business meeting, an airport, the theater, or just shopping around town. Larchmont's Depot Taxi and Limousine Services welcomes new accounts. If you call them at 914-834-4000, you'll find the number for Larchmont's Depot Taxi will be a number you'll always call when it comes to transportation. Ever reliable. Larchmont's Depot Taxi and Limousine Service is the ultimate in riding with style and with prices which are truly fair. Their drivers are neatly dressed, always anxious to please, and will safely deliver you to your destination. In Larchmont, the number to call, 834-4000.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Our weather forecast for today calling for skies to be sunny in the early going, then partly sunny this afternoon, or highs in the upper 80s. Just a 20% chance of a late-day thundershower. That chance increases to 50% tonight. Under clouds, showers and thunderstorms likely overnight in the lower 70s. More showers and thunderstorms are likely on Friday. Some of the thunderstorms tomorrow could give us strong gusty winds and heavy downpours, or highs for the day, ranging in the lower 80s, lows at night in the lower 70s. Saturday's weather, clouds and showers and some thunderstorms. Some afternoon sun, but the chance at rain, still 70% for Saturday. Saturday's highs in the middle 80s. Sunday, mostly sunny, highs of 80 to 85. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
no matter where you go.
Driving in truck all day long?
Driving to work.
We're right there with you. WVOX Worldwide.
1460 WVOX.
Okay, we are back. This is Bob Lebensold. The program is Environmentally Sound. We are interviewing Matt Hayashida today. Matt is a musher. Those of you who are just tuning in late, a musher is a sled dog driver who, I guess you could be a musher and not enter the Iditarod, but Matt is absolutely an Iditarod racer. He rides a thousand and something miles through frozen Arctic tundra each March, or not each March, he's missed a couple, I think, we'll get that clear. And the distance, as he has just informed us, is something like New York City to Miami. So try to imagine getting on a sled here in New Rochelle or in Westchester County, wherever you're listening, in Southern Connecticut or Northern Bronx or wherever you are, North Shore of Long Island, and getting on a sled in sub-zero temperature with dogs pulling you, 16 or fewer dogs pulling you, and going all the way to Miami with no let up in the weather, with just a few stops along the way. Try to imagine that, and you'll have some handle on the gentleman who we are talking to. Okay, Matt, welcome back. Tell us now, we know how far it is. We know how long it takes, between 9 and 15 days, I think. But tell us about the weather. How cold does it get? Does it sometimes get blizzardy, and is it ever impassable? Does it ever get to a point where you just have to stop? And also, what season of the year? I was a little surprised to find out when this race is. Please answer those questions, Matt.
Right. I would say that the average temperature during the race is, and mind you, the race takes place the first Saturday in March, so it's pretty close to the equinox, and there's almost as much sunlight as there is darkness that time of year. So there can actually be some pretty major temperature fluctuations. Now, the average temperature being about 10 below zero. Now, it very rarely is 10 below zero. It's more of an extreme in March weather patterns that we get there. The coldest stagnant temperature that I've ever felt was 65 below zero.
65.
And that would be at the old gold mining town of Iditarod, from what the race is named. And a few years later, the warmest temperature I ever felt during the race was actually 48 above zero Fahrenheit. And that, too, was at the old gold mining town of Iditarod. And that year, there was actually the jet stream was coming straight up from Hawaii, and we were dealing with melting snow, and some places no snow. And you think that that might be a little bit easier, but that's just as difficult as when it's 65 below or even 20 or 30 below and the wind is blowing. And, you know, it's almost as difficult to navigate on the trail because there, quite frankly, there is no trail.
And you mentioned that trades were blowing up from Hawaii. And anyone who, if you want to look at a map, anybody, or a globe, you'll see that actually Alaska juts pretty far west off the North American continent. And it's pretty much north of Hawaii. Hawaii's a little bit further west, but it's mostly south. So actually the winds are blowing up, as you say. That's real interesting. I did not know that. I imagined that Hawaii was way west, but when I looked at a globe last night, I see that I was wrong. Now, tell me, first of all, Matt, does everyone who starts the race finish the race? I know some of the dogs drop out, but do any of the mushers themselves drop out?
It actually depends upon the year. And on a warm race year, I'd say a good percentage of teams probably finished the race, maybe close to around 85 or 90% of the teams finished the race. If it's a really cold race, or very difficult, very windy, stormy, you'll see a little bit higher percentage not finishing. You know, maybe I'd say on a really bad year where there are a lot of scratch teams, you're looking at maybe 70% that finish the Iditarod on those years. And most of the reason why those teams are scratched has really nothing to do with the dogs. It usually just has to do with the dog mushers and their inability to finish.
Okay. How many times have you personally raced? What is the best position you have finished in, and do you intend to race next March?
Yes, I've competed in the Iditarod 7 times. My rookie year, I placed 36th, then I was 33rd, and then I was 29th, and 28th, 27th, then 22nd, and then 21st. So I figured maybe in another 20 years I'll get there. But anyways, it's about a 50% chance that I'll run this next year. It is a very very large financial endeavor to go and do something like this. We spend a lot of money for the care of the dogs and the proper food, which is very expensive, and just different things. And in order to do it properly, it's one of those things that you have to have 100% dedication to it. So, but I give it about a 50% chance. We have until November to sign up, and the race doesn't start, of course, until March. So that would give me ample time to prepare for the race if I were to decide to sign up.
Well, I certainly hope you do, because I'd love to follow someone I know. I think it was you who told the joke something about you need to have a team, a sled, and a wife, and all of them have to work. Was that you?
Yes. So, and one of the prizes, if you win the Iditarod, you get $50,000 in a brand new Dodge pickup truck. There are three things that every Alaskan man needs. We need a pickup truck, a chainsaw, and a wife. And all three have to work.
That's because it's expensive. But you can also, if you win, there's prize money. Does only the winner win, or get money, or are the first three or the first 10? How is the money distributed?
Well, the purse, the purse is anywhere, the overall purse is anywhere from, say, $650,000 to $900,000, depending on the year. And all that money gets distributed amongst the top 30 teams. Now, if you place out of the top 30, and you finish, then you receive $1,049, a dollar for each mile completed during the race.
So you have actually finished in the money 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times out of your 7 races.
Yes.
Is it a substantial amount? Does it offset your investment, or do you have to be one of the really top guys to actually offset the investment?
For me, over the years, I of course, have gained various sponsorships. And for me, if I place in the money somewhere, it seems like I've maybe broke even on the whole endeavor between the sponsorships and the race winnings versus the cost of it. So, and that's fine. I'm happy with that. It's more, for me, this is more of a passion and a lifestyle. My mother always taught us, follow your passion and the money will follow. Well, I'm still waiting for the money part.
But it's good advice. Tell us about women racers. I would imagine that this is just a men's sport, and the only females might be some dogs. Tell us, how am I wrong about that?
Yeah, there's nearly every year maybe 15% of the field are women, and it's one of the few major sporting events in the world where men and women can compete together. And in 1985, Libby Riddles became the first woman to win the Iditarod. And then in 1986, 87, 88, and 1990, all those races were won by Susan Buescher. So women had won the Iditarod 5 out of 6 years. And that's why we have the saying up here, Alaska where the men are men and the women win Iditarod.
So that's it's counterintuitive to me, but that, I guess that's vestiges of sexism in me. I always think that anything really rugged is going to be a man's sport. But this afternoon, actually, we have an American teenager, a high school girl, who's boxing for the gold. So so I guess, you know, we have to rethink all that stuff. Is your goal actually to win?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll just answer that question quickly. Is your goal
Yes.
Okay. We'll come back and we'll pursue that question. You're listening to WVOX AM 1460. This is Environmentally Sound. If you're listening in Rochester, New York, or Rochester Hills, Michigan, Covina, or West Covina, California, Salem, Oregon, or Salem, Massachusetts, Rockland, Maine, or those parts of Rockland County, New York, which do not receive our broadcast signal, you have logged on to www.wvox.com. You are listening live. I am Bob Lebensold. Nick is in the behind the glass. And we will be right back.
And national news 3 times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. He's in the middle of a Colorado campaign trip, President Obama using it to say that Mitt Romney supporters want to make health care and contraception more costly.
They want to take us back to the policies more suited to the 1950s than the 21st century.
In Grand Junction, he paints the former Massachusetts governor as a protector of the rich. And at the state fairgrounds here in Pueblo, the president is expected to focus on middle-class workers and the economy. This as Romney supporters, like Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, continue their Colorado buzz tour while Romney fundraises in New York.
Fox News Radio's Jennifer Kuiper in Pueblo, Colorado. Realtors say there was a drop last month in foreclosures on home loans.
For the 22nd consecutive month, overall foreclosure activity fell by 3%, and for the year is down 10%.
Fox News Radio's Jared Halpern in Washington. Fox News, we report, you decide.
The city of Neuchâtel has long awaited the release of the 10-10-10 project book. It is finally here. On October 10th, 2010, dozens of volunteer photographers fanned out through our fair city to capture the people and places, events and activities, history and life of New Rochelle. Photographers spent an entire day taking thousands of pictures from the north end to the waterfront, from the east side to the west end, top to bottom, side to side. Photographers took to bicycles, kayaks, boats, and even a small engine plane to capture the brilliance of a gorgeous full Sunday. The 10-10-10 project book is 160 full-color and full-size pages, hardbound, and contains forewords by Mayor Bramson and city historian Barbara Davis, with witty and delightful captions by Bill Mullen. Reserve your copy now and save $10. Books can be ordered now at the pre-publication discount price of $29.95 at 10-10-10-NR.com. The profits from the book will be given to the Thomas Paine Cottage. Order your book now at 10-10-10-NR.com.
We make it very easy for you to get on the air and talk to your neighbors.
Could someone talk to me?
And the world.
This station is now the ultimate power in the universe.
The podium is yours.
Impressive.
AM 1460 and worldwide at WVOX.com.
1460 WVOX. Okay, we are back. I am Bob Lovensoul. This is our last segment. My guest today is Matt Hayashida. He is a musher, a dog sled racer. Fascinating. I did visit his tour facility up in Skagway, Alaska, a month or so ago, and I was on a cruise. And I saw the dogs, the love, the way they're handled, the way they want to run. I was just very taken by the whole process and by the love someone can have of a sport, and particularly such a sport. I mean, you get on a dog sled and you have, of course, you're bundled up naturally against such severe climate, weather conditions, and you're just out there for over 1,000 miles for 10 days. Wow. And women do it, which is an eye-opener for me as well. Okay, so, Matt, just before the break, I asked if it was your goal to win or you just did it for the challenge. You said yes. Very, very definitively, you said yes. You do it. You do it. You want to win it. Yes? You're on, Matt.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Winning is certainly the goal. But, you know, there's also, and I believe all the mushers share this viewpoint, is, you know, even though we're in a race and we're, you know, we're all competitors, and the key is, of course, in any race is to win and to do that. But the thing is you got to do it right by the dog. So if you know, the race is really not, it's almost impossible when you run dogs and you're mushing dogs. You can't push a rope. The dogs are pulling the rope, so you're really limited by what kind of condition that the dogs are in and how you've trained the dogs. And also, we found that you know, with our run rest cycle, most of us have figured out what is optimum. And obviously, the separation between first and second or third or last place is based upon what the dogs are capable of doing and maintaining their speed. Now, some of the racers do take a long time. They may take 12, 14, 15, sometimes 16 days to complete the Iditarod, almost a week after first place. And so there is obviously an amateur class that is that runs the same course simultaneously with the professionals. Anyways, yeah, we're building our kennel and we're you know, hopefully one of these days, yeah, we'll get there.
Well, I'll be following you, so I certainly hope that too. But now, like for instance, with the New York Yankees, they buy the best players, and you arguably they have an advantage because they have more money. But I imagine the dogs are dogs, and you know how to train them as well as anybody else does, the sleds and all the rest of the equipment, and you're a husky guy in great shape. So what is the difference between those who finish first and those who finish 10th?
Well, probably the easiest way that I can describe it would be, and with our run schedule that we do, we on average will run the dogs about 6 hours at a time during the race. And then on average, we'll rest the dogs about 6 hours. So there's an equal run rest ratio that we do throughout the race. Now, this isn't mandatory. This run rest rotation that we do is at the musher's discretion. So I believe that the difference could be if your team is a little bit faster, and if it takes you, say, 5.5 hours to do the same run that it took another musher 6 hours, then you can probably get by with 5.5 hours of rest, thus placing you an hour ahead of that other musher. And some teams can maybe run for 6 hours and then rest for maybe 5 hours and 15 minutes. If you feel like you can cut your rest somewhat and still maintain your speed. So there's nothing that doesn't tell us that we couldn't run our dogs for 20 hours straight.
Okay.
Of course, nobody does that. I mean, you would be in first place for a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Because what would happen is the dog's speed would decline so much that you would never regain that speed the rest of the race. So
I get you.
You'd be really limiting yourself by trying to push the dog team above and beyond its own capabilities.
Okay, so you're talking about the dogs. So let's talk about the dogs. The Alaskan Husky, I always figured there was an Alaskan Husky, a Siberian Husky, and a Malamute. Those were the three dogs. But I was enlightened when I visited you. The Alaskan Husky is actually not a an officially recognized breed. Why is that?
Yeah, and that's a really good thing. So, yes, the two recognized breeds that most people associate with this type of thing would be the Alaskan Malamute and the Siberian Husky, which, of course, are both recognized by the American Kennel Clubs and the different kennel clubs around the world, too. The Alaskan Husky is really just more of a designation. It's kind of like the working version Husky. The Alaskan Husky is really just a fancy name for a mixed breed dog that pulls. So what we've done with the breedings is we're just basing our breedings all off of performance and athleticism. So we don't have to adhere to any strict breed standards when breeding these dogs, which is a good thing because, of course, we're breeding the best athletes and the healthiest dogs. That way, if some of these genetic problems that you have with interbreeding dogs or some of these purebred dogs, say like hip dysplasia or arthritis, you don't see these in these sled dogs because, again, we're not doing any of the breedings based on looks. It's all off of athletic performance.
So if you were to...
That's the difference.
If you were to race a team of fit Alaskan Huskies against a team of Malamutes and a team of Siberian Huskies, would the Alaskan Huskies just win going away?
Oh, with the the Alaskan Huskies would easily win the race. The Siberian Huskies would come in probably second place, and the Alaskan Malamutes, I don't even believe a Malamute has ever finished the Iditarod, simply because of the time constraints. If you're too far behind the rest of the pack, the Iditarod Trail Committee will actually pull you out of the race.
Huh.
For being non-competitive, and a Malamute, I always say you never see a sumo wrestler winning any marathons, and the Malamutes can pull heavy loads all day long, just not very quickly.
Okay. Now, the dogs I saw in your kennel are actually small dogs. They're like 40 pounds or so. They're really not large dogs. Is that
right? The Alaskan Husky, on average, weighs about 50 pounds. Surprisingly small, but if you compare them to their human counterparts, say an ultra marathoner or just any kind of marathon runner, it does make kind of sense looking at that.
The most famous event in the history of Alaskan mushing was the 1925 Serum Run to Nome, also known as the Great Race of Mercy. Something about a diphtheria epidemic and delivering serum. Are you familiar with the details of that?
Yeah. So the 1925, there, what happened was the diphtheria broke out in Nome, and there was no way to get the serum there. All the planes at that time in Alaska were shut down for the winter. Plus, it was really stormy weather, so it was unsafe to fly. And the serum actually came up by steamship from Seattle to Seward, Alaska. And then it came from Seward all the way to Nenana, Alaska, by rail car. So what they did was they organized all the mail carriers. They still delivered mail by dog team. So all the mail carriers of the day, there was 18 of them, left. They organized a relay, and they passed the serum on to one another. And it's about 700 miles from Nenana to Nome. They covered that distance in less than 5 days, passing the serum on, running day and night, and thawing out the serum at certain times and trying to keep it as warm as possible. Now, it did arrive to Nome frozen, but it was okay. And they ended up saving many lives.
And Balto,
because of this serum run.
Balto was on that run, right?
Yeah, so Balto just happened to be the lead dog on the final leg.
Okay.
So he got all the glory.
Yeah.
The real hero of the serum run was a dog named Togo, who ran lead through a storm on a 90-mile stretch.
Wow.
But he's mostly unsung. But those who know about it realize that Togo, spelled T-O-G-O, was the real hero that got the serum through the most difficult leg of the relay.
Cool, and many lives were saved. I have one quick question, Matt. I've heard that sled dogs can defecate on the run. They do not have to stop. You don't have to walk them on a leash. They can just let fly while they're running and not miss a step. Now, I always thought that was specific to a breed, but since the Alaskan Husky is such a mixed breed, is that a behavior that can be trained into an animal?
Yes. It is kind of a neat trick. And when we're training these dogs, we set up the dogs to succeed. So a young dog, the easiest way to train an animal, I believe, is to place a dog, a younger dog, next to an older dog. And they will learn quite a bit from that older dog.
Now, including how to defecate on the fly.
Defecation on the run. Yeah, well, now that is basically the rest of the team is running along. And the dog will, it does. And I'm not sure if it's breed specific, but they do it. And it's kind of an interesting. Some dogs are a little bit better at it than others.
Okay, Matt, I have to cut you off. I'm sorry. It's been a great interview, and I wish you all the best. And I do hope that you run in 2013. I'll be following you.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. Okay. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. I'd like to thank Matt Hayashida. I don't have too much time. He woke up before 6 a.m. to join us 4 hours earlier. It is now 7 a.m., just before 7 a.m. in Skagway, but what a life it is. Daring to risk your life in conditions which are really unfit for habitation. Bye for now.
Your official summertime station.
It's just a fun station to listen to, especially in the summer.
WVOX and WVOX.